From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today on the program, what Shakespeare had to say about tyrants. The scholar Stephen Greenblatt is our guest. He's written a book about the questions Shakespeare seems to be asking a lot in his plays. Why would anyone be drawn to a leader who was unsuited to govern? Because there are a lot of crummy leaders in Shakespeare's plays. But how is it that they came to power? We'll be right back.
Hi, this is Benjamin Bombard, one of the producers of Radio West. A lot of people want to know, does Doug really read all those books? The answer, yeah, he does. No one really knows how, but we do know that he gets up very early. If you want to try keeping up with him, you can buy the book by clicking on the indie bookstores, Amazon, or Audible links at the bottom of the episode page. If you do, some of the proceeds go to support Radio West. So thanks for that, and thanks for listening. Here's the show.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. William Shakespeare was no dummy, and there was no such thing as freedom of expression in the England of his time. So we don't know what he really thought about the leadership of Queen Elizabeth because he was smart enough to keep his mouth shut. The scholar Stephen Greenblatt says Shakespeare was a master of displacement and indirection. In other words, he never wrote plays about contemporary politics in contemporary England. He created characters from the ancient past in far-off places. But clearly, he was interested in politics, or at least the human dynamics of power and manipulation. Greenblatt says Shakespeare was interested in the ways communities disintegrate, how it was people allowed a dangerous demagogue to lead them, how they dealt with the disaster, and how they tried to fix things. Stephen Greenblatt is the Kogan University Professor of Humanities at Harvard University. His books include Will in the World and The Swerve. He joined us recently to talk about his latest book, which is called Tyrant, Shakespeare on Politics. Greenblatt says we don't know if William Shakespeare thought Queen Elizabeth was a tyrant, but he says he was writing at a time when the queen was aging and she had no successor, so he was really worried that the country could fall into terrible hands.
I don't think myself, but we could imagine that there would be a debate about this, that it was because Shakespeare thought that the ruler entering his career, Queen Elizabeth, was herself a tyrant. There were some people who thought that she was, people in the Catholic community particularly. But I don't see evidence that Shakespeare joined that view. But he was writing in the 1590s when the queen was aging, when the handwriting was on the wall, and he was concerned and had good reason to be concerned, along with his fellow countrymen and women, that the country might fall into terrible hands. She hadn't named a successor.
Right.
There were various people maneuvering. And then beyond that, Doug, Shakespeare had a sense of history.
Right.
Of English history, but then of other countries as well, of the history he had encountered and the reading he had done. And he knew that it can happen, that societies that seem stable and secure can, for whatever reason, fall into disarray, fall into terrible hands, go into dark and dangerous places.
Yeah.
He knew this from ancient history. He knew it from the history of Europe in the centuries before him.
You mentioned he was interested in the ways communities disintegrate. This wasn't just a commentary. Obviously, he was no dummy. He wasn't going to make a commentary on Elizabeth or the Elizabethan contemporary moment. But it seems like he had a broader interest, and probably it seems to me maybe even as this idea of not just the ways communities disintegrate, but the characters and the potential for great characters in all of these things.
Yes, of course, he's interested as a playwright, as a professional dramatist who's interested in great stories. He is, as you've suggested, also someone who had a lifelong interest in staying out of prison and keeping his head on his shoulders. He lived in a time with nothing even remotely resembling the notion of freedom of speech or a public sphere where you could say what you think. He understood in a very deep way the virtues and the necessity of obliquity, But that obliquity has, though it must have in some situations seemed terrible, also led to a vastly heightened sensitivity to the power of perspective, to looking at things from an angle, to turning back into other situations. And I respect that. And then beyond that, as your question suggests, he asked all his life, both as a professional playwright but just as a thoughtful and sensitive human being, questions about what kind of world do we want to live in?
Yeah.
What values do we cherish and respect? And conversely, what do we regard as intolerable? Shakespeare's tragedies are fundamentally about the intolerable, things becoming unbearable.
Shakespeare was, you say, ruthlessly honest. And I expect that must have been refreshing to the audiences of the time. It must have been one of the reasons why his plays were popular.
I think that's true, Doug. I think that the audiences of his time spent by necessity and also of choice a tremendous amount of time listening to sermons and other official speeches, some of which had a great deal of wisdom in them, but others of which were full of the flapdoodle that sermons and speeches are often full of. And I think that it was, and that was true, of course, of a lot of the art that was produced in the time as well. But I think people did, we have evidence that people did find it remarkably exciting to be in a space, as I say, in a world without much in the way of democratic public space, to be in a space in which the truth or what seemed like the truth could be aired.
Hmm. You say Shakespeare seemed to be suggesting that, and this maybe was a theme I wanted to ask you about, that tyrants come to power through the complicity of their subjects.
Yes, it's true. At least Shakespeare thought so. He never thought that this was done simply by one person of extraordinary power. And in general, if you think about Shakespeare, if you put the question of tyrants specifically aside for a second, Shakespeare clearly throughout his career asks how we resist the evil of which we know we're capable.
Yeah.
The cruelty, the boundless greed, the hatred of others, the pleasure of inflicting pain, power hunger. How does society, how do individuals protect themselves from disasters? How, in effect, can we choose life and freedom and not death and slavery?
It's interesting you mentioned how Shakespeare understood that when people are in the thick of it, they don't really have the perspective to see when it's coming, that, you know, as you say, the calamity is in the works. And you mentioned how he created this character Rumor, for example, to kind of, I guess, illustrate the missed signals at times that come through.
Yes, Shakespeare seems to have believed what I have come to believe, I have to say, in my life, which is that the people whom you think know, who are in the inside track and can calculate correctly what's to come, actually, sometimes they know a little bit more. But finally, they seem to know very little about what's to come. In retrospect, there's always someone who seems to have known. But in the actual event itself, in the middle of it, even people who are, you think, at the center of power, who have access to the networks of spies, reports, and so forth and so on, they're taken by surprise. And Shakespeare has a very powerful allegorical figure for this in the figure of Rumor in Henry IV, Part II. But it is throughout his work, his history works, the sense that you just don't know what's coming. Look at our own time, Doug. Look at the surprises to which apparently people very central in our world of information, the surprises that have beset them. It turns out there weren't weapons of mass destruction, or it turns out that the Soviet Union was much weaker than we thought it was, and so forth and so on, where huge efforts were made to gather information, most up-to-date, the most immediate and the most reliable information, and they turn out to have failed miserably.
You say Shakespeare always depicted the tragic cost of giving in to a tyrant. In that sense, was he showing the kind of comeuppance then? Did he always sort of tidy it up at the end and show this is the cost? Was it always that? I don't want to oversimplify it, but was that what he was showing?
Well, he does seem to ultimately to share the view that these disastrous situations don't last forever. And we know that that's true of what leads us into a very dark place may, in the end, lead us out of it again. I mean, that nothing is forever. But that's also true of the good times. I think that he thought that there were consequences, real-world consequences, here and now, not in some imaginary afterlife, to cruelty, cheating, lying, dishonor. I think he thought eventually a world of sharks would turn on each other and eat each other. Or that the forces of goodness would be resurgent and would restore order. But he didn't think that this was going to be easy, and he actually has, I think, a rather tough-minded and realistic account of what the price is. The most extreme version is at the end of King Lear, when no one seems to want to be in power at the end, and when the one person who steps forward says, "We that are young shall never live so long nor see so much. We're just in basically disorder. We've been damaged terribly." And I think Shakespeare was very sensitive to the damage that's done and the risks that are run. But as I say, he wasn't a desperate pessimist. He thought that we could get out. This is a man who wrote comedies in his life as well as tragedies.
Right. You mentioned Queen Elizabeth. You know, she could be imperious and prickly, but Shakespeare, we don't think, saw her as a tyrant. And you say in the book that Elizabeth had this respect for the institutions of power. And I wanted to ask you about this. I thought this was really interesting. You say that there was also at the time this sense that there was this kind of terrorism conspiracy afoot, which I think is an interesting parallel to our time.
There was widespread fear in England, particularly among those in positions of authority in the church and state, that there was a network, a conspiracy that was organized to bring down the church and the state, to attack it, in touch with each other, secretly funded from foreign powers, but working within, usually with young men and with people who felt that they had nothing to lose, or more specifically, people who felt that God had given them the specific instruction to bring the hated, in this case, the hated Protestants down and restore Catholicism. And the authorities who thought so were not being entirely paranoid. There were people, not as many as they thought, not as organized as they feared, but there were people who would like to have assassinated the Queen, would like to have restored the Catholic faith that had been toppled by the Queen's father, Henry VIII, and who did, after the Queen's lifetime, who did in the early years, 1605, of the rule of James I, actually try to blow up the Houses of Parliament and kill the King and his family. So this is wasn't simply official paranoia. And the question was how to deal with it, what to do. And there was a debate, a very serious ongoing debate in Elizabeth's time and extending into James's time about what to do. And there were people who thought that it was time to get tough on terror. And they had a variety of different ways of proposing to do so. And of course, there was a tremendous amount of cruelty toward those that the secret police, the Elizabethan secret police, caught and interrogated. But the Queen made a decision that upset some of her most hardline supporters, which was that, as she put it, she didn't want to rip up men's souls. She didn't want to inquire too closely into what people believed. I think she herself probably, and we know that there were certain things that she kept in her own chapel that would have been disapproved of by hardline Protestants. So she wasn't willing to go there. And there were people who felt that she had to go there. And they went back and forth in her regime. She resisted for a very long time executing her cousin, Mary, Queen of Scots. She was finally, in effect, forced to do so. But she was very wary about organizing the state as a kind of counter-terror institution. She was quite conservative in the old-fashioned way of speaking of conservatives. She was against radical measures.
So there's this anxiety about the country and the government as Elizabeth gets older, you mention. And she, of course, Shakespeare couldn't really say anything directly about it on the stage. So he found, as you mentioned, he found ways, these oblique angles of coming at this. He had others other ways of addressing all of this. And so he shifts the scene to far off places and or the distant past. And I wondered if censors, you mentioned that there would be censors who would go to the plays, not just Shakespeare's, but others, of course. Were they looking for the sedition? Were they looking for these parallels in the plays?
Absolutely, they were. The plays were playhouses were, but not just the playhouses, also taverns, inns, and so forth, were populated by spies who would report in exchange for rewards, who would report when there were remarks made that could be construed to be seditious or to be blasphemous. So it was definitely – it's a world – the world of the old Eastern Bloc, Soviet Union, GDR, mm-hmm. Czechoslovakia, the world of countries like Iran and North Korea, where it's extremely dangerous to be caught saying things that the government will interpret as seditious. And so Shakespeare had to be extremely careful, and that helps you – encourages you to write about ancient Rome or about Britain at the time of – roughly at the time of – the prophet Isaiah, and not about your own time. So Walter Raleigh, when he was imprisoned in the Tower of London in the reign of Elizabeth's successor, James I, wrote a history of the world. And he began at the creation, and he took it up to, I can't remember any longer, something like 180 BCE. Yeah. And then he was asked, why didn't he write about his own time, about which he knew so much? And he said, he who follows truth too close at the heels is likely to get his teeth kicked out. And that's something that everyone understood, Shakespeare understood.
Right.
He didn't want to follow truth too close to the heels. But it wasn't just a question – I just want to add, Doug. It wasn't just a question, I think, of being sly or coy. It's an attempt on Shakespeare's part to use the preoccupations and passions of his own time, of the present moment, as a way to illuminate and enter into the past.
Sure. Yeah.
And particularly aspects of the past that may have eluded attention. And at the same time, and in the very doing so, it's an attempt to use the past to shed light on the present. Mm. And I think that's what Shakespeare did. I put it that way because I think it's what we all do when we – those of us who are interested in the past, who are interested in escaping from the immediate noise of the present. Sometimes when the noise gets so great in our own world, the pressure of events, the fears, the rage – it's actually liberating to look away a little bit, not that you're escaping, but that you're looking aslant in order to see things more clearly.
Hmm. I should mention, because I was kind of delighted by this section, there was one moment when he got a little close to home in Henry V. There's a fascinating detail in this story. On the day before this, there's this attempted coup and tell the story a little bit about how Henry V does almost get him into trouble.
Shakespeare was writing Henry V in the latter part of the 1590s when, as I said, the situation is getting more and more preoccupying in England about what's to come. And he does something in Henry V that he almost never did in his career, which is that he sailed his little ship very close to his own contemporary world, namely, without naming him by name, when he's talking about the triumphant Henry V returning from the Battle of Agincourt to England, Shakespeare alludes to Queen Elizabeth's favorite, the Earl of Essex, who was in Ireland at the time, trying to put down Irish rebellion number 10,500,000. I mean, they're always trying to put the Irish down. And like all of those attempts, it didn't work. But Essex was very confident that he would be able to solve this problem. And he went off. And then in the face of his failure to do so, Essex was a very tempestuous and rash man. He returned against the Queen's explicit orders to London. He threw himself. He broke into her private rooms. In fact, he threw himself down, covered with mud, dirt, having just come straight from the road, and said that his enemies were – he was, as I say, rather unstable, paranoid fellow – that his enemies were trying to do him in. Well, he did have enemies, and that she needed to protect him. She was alarmed by this behavior, told him to go away. He got more and more anxious, concerned about his enemies, Cecil, Raleigh. He had this was a court world in which, of course, we never encounter such a world in our own time, in which people are fighting with each other within an administration. But that's what was happening in Elizabeth's world. They hated each other within the administration and were fighting it out. And the Earl of Essex decided to do something extravagantly dangerous, which was to stage, in effect, a kind of putsch or coup. Now, Shakespeare, as I said, had publicly praised the Earl of Essex just very shortly before these events. And that wasn't all. What Essex did was to have his principal advisor go the day before the coup to go across the river to the theater and approach Shakespeare's company, the Lord Chamberlain's men, and ask them to perform a play that Shakespeare had written several years before called Richard II. Richard II is a play about, in effect, a rising, a coup that topples the king, Richard II, who was eventually killed by a new ruler. Shakespeare's company said, no, that was an old play, and they didn't want to do it. Wouldn't be worth putting it on in the public theater because there wouldn't be an audience for it. And Essex's principal advisor, a man named Sir Julian Marrick, paid that company what was for the time a great deal of money to revive this old play and to put it on the day before the coup. So the next day, Essex stages his rising and he marches with his followers into the city of London and then toward the places where his enemies are, and no one rises up with him, so he loses.
Right.
He's arrested, the followers are arrested, and Essex is executed. But not Essex alone. The government looks into how this happened, who was behind it, and they cast their attention on this play, a play by William Shakespeare, who had, after all, written an explicit compliment about Essex not so long before. So that could have got Shakespeare into unbelievable trouble.
Yeah.
And that it didn't is still a bit of a mystery to us. What we know is that not Shakespeare himself, but one of the principal members of the company, is called in to testify before the Privy Council, the Queen's counselors, and they ask him, what exactly did he think he was doing putting on this play? And he said with a kind of, I guess, disarming frankness, we just wanted to make some money.
Yeah.
They offered us some money and we did it. That's all. And for whatever reason, that explanation, which would not by any means have always worked if you got in terrible trouble with the government, that explanation worked. Maybe the Queen just liked the company and wanted it to go on.
Yeah.
But Shakespeare and the company escapes from what might otherwise have led to a very grisly end.
What I like about the story, too, is that Essex supporters really believed in the potential power of a play to stir the crowd. I thought that was interesting.
Evidently. I mean, even it's strange to us, actually, doubly strange to us, not only because we can be doubtful about whether plays can help uprisings or not, treasonous uprisings in this case, but also because actually academics like me say all the time, look, if you read Richard II, you discover it's very ambivalent about the ethical validation of uprising, even against an inadequate or improper, or even up against Richard II, who's actually not a good monarch. So I say to my students all the time, look, if you look at the play carefully, you look at it with the least bit of attention, you see that it's not actually supporting uprisings. But something in the act of staging the killing of a king was evidently enough in Shakespeare's time to excite, at least in the minds of the conspirators, the possibility that this would give them some support.
Mm.
And look, Doug, something happened in the 1590s, 1610s, 1620s and onward. Lots of plays are put on showing kings being killed.
Yeah.
And the interesting thing is that I write about this briefly in my book. The treason statute going all the way back to Henry VIII said that it was treasonous. The words were to compass or imagine the death of the king.
Imagine,
to compass meaning to do or imagine the death of the king. And here we have on the public stage before 3,000 people in the afternoon the imagining, the staging and the imagining of the death of a king. And then in 1649, lo and behold, the English cut off the head of their king. So is there a relation between the two things? Actually, I think there is, that there was several generations of imagining the death of a monarch that helped to prepare the English for the incredibly fateful act of holding their king to accounts for betraying the Commonwealth, for betraying the kingdom.
Stephen Greenblatt. His book is called Tyrant, Shakespeare on Politics. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER.
With the KUER app, you'll never have to choose between Doug Fabrizio and a phone call from your spouse. Just hit the pause button and take the call. When you're ready, hit play and it's back to Radio West. The KUER app lets you pause whatever you're listening to, and you can get a constant feed of BBC News and classical music with our other streams, BBC on KUER and KUER Classical. It's even got an alarm clock, so you can wake up with Diane Mezzapinto's Moon Report and Morning Edition. Download the KUER app for iPhone and Android today. It'll help you be a better partner.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we have with us the Harvard scholar Stephen Greenblatt. We're talking about his latest book. It's called Tyrant, Shakespeare on Politics. So Shakespeare is, of course, thinking about how it is that a great country could end up with a sociopath. And he writes about King Richard III. Let's talk about this play and this character. Physically deformed, Richard III, Shakespeare saw him as tormented, as you put it, by insecurity and rage and, of course, self-loathing. And what's interesting, I think, about this, now this is one of Shakespeare's first big hits, you say, and in it, Richard does not come to power through a coup d'etat. Rather, there is, as you say, a soliciting of popular votes. Why did Shakespeare choose this as an election? I guess this gets us back to the idea of complicity. This is really interesting.
Yes. In some ways, incredible, because after all, kings didn't come to power in Shakespeare's world through election,
right,
at least not in England. So it's a very strange idea, and it's not only in Richard III that Shakespeare shows himself interested in it. He repeatedly comes back in the course of his career to an idea that might not necessarily have figured prominently in his work at all. It doesn't figure prominently in the work of other contemporary playwrights, and that's the idea of popular voting, of electing. And electing a catastrophic leader. So the question of what is why? And I guess my answer would pull in two different directions. One is simply a direction toward Shakespeare's own business. Shakespeare was in the business of manipulating support, manipulating the public for applause. He's fascinated by doing it. He's the greatest doer of it that we know, probably in the history of the world. So why shouldn't he be interested in elections and how you manipulate crowds and how you get them to be on your side? He's fascinated by that, and he's professionally interested in it. So that's on the one hand. And on the other hand, you have a kind of canniness that goes back to something we said at the very beginning of this conversation about the fact that it's never one person, even one astonishing person, as Richard III is, grotesque and horrible, but also funny and vital and crazy and seductive. But you also need complicity, as you've said. And Shakespeare is fascinated in that play both by the extraordinary personality of the king or of the Duke of Gloucester who becomes king, but also in those who surround him and make it possible for him. When someone who really shouldn't be in power comes to power, Shakespeare at least believes that most people know that it's not an appropriate choice, that it isn't something they should opt for. So why do they let it happen? And what he does in Richard III is to give you a kind of sketch, a brilliant sketch in the guise of individual characters of the kind of people who enable a political catastrophe like this to happen.
Right.
I mean, there are some people who are simply fooled, but Shakespeare thinks those are mostly little kids who have no life experience. And there are some people who are frightened into acceding to this, who are threatened or overmastered. But then that's not the whole story. And there are a variety of other ways he thought that people allow this to happen. There are those who seem to forget, weirdly enough, even though they've seen for themselves how dangerous the situation is, who seem to normalize what is an abnormal situation.
Yeah.
They look around. They get this isn't the way it's supposed to be. But weirdly enough, they have amnesia about it, as if they had a kind of impulse to pull everything back to what they think is the ordinary normative way politics works. And then there are those who trust somehow that the traditional system will hold up, even though it's under tremendous pressure, who think that it will endure a particularly rowdy and miserable threat. And then there are people who think they can take advantage of the situation to get back at their enemies, as Lord Hastings thinks he's going to do, to get some money out of this. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, there are lots of others. There are those who are good, obedient servants of the state, who carry out orders, who cut someone's head off if you tell them to cut his head off, who do the things that you do if you work obediently for the state, whatever the state is.
Yeah. You know what the most disturbing part of this is, though? Another one of these elements that you write about, and this is the one that you call the strangest of all. And I'll quote you here. Those who take vicarious pleasure in the release of pent-up aggression, the black humor of it all, the open speaking of the unspeakable. Talk a little bit about that. What is that impulse as you understand it? That because people, as you say, loved every minute of people watching Richard III come to power. People loved watching it. And I wonder, what's that impulse as you understand it?
First thing I guess I'd say, Doug, is that that's we.
Yeah, yeah.
those people are we.
Yes.
And for the last 400 years, Richard III has worked that way as a play to make us take delight in something that we know is ghastly and catastrophic. And that extends, I think, in Shakespeare's account, not simply to the theater itself, but outside the walls of the theater, to how people respond, at least initially, to the excitement of violating the rules. Shakespeare thought that there was – he thought this not just in Richard III. He thought this in his earlier play, Henry VI, much less well-known, with the grotesque figure of Jack Cade. People enjoy the violation of the rules. It's like a holiday, a vacation from polite behavior, the thrill of saying things and doing things that you're not ordinarily allowed to do. Mm. Why is that, of course? That's a good question. It's a question that goes back, how shall we say, to the book of Genesis, to why humans the first humans ate the apple.
Yeah.
People like to violate the structure of things, at least for a while.
Yeah, right. Let's talk more about Jack Cade, because this gets us to the question of this kind of fraudulent populism. Cade, of course, was an actual person. This was interesting. The Duke of York doesn't care much about Jack Cade, but he sees in him some qualities that could make him useful. He was good at manipulating crowds. He promises to make England great again. Talk a little bit about Jack Cade, where he fits in this.
Shakespeare got from his source, his historical source, that there was an uprising in the preceding century that had been, in effect, released, funded by someone very, very high up in the aristocracy, but it was a popular uprising. So Shakespeare understood, first of all, that what looks like a kind of movement from below is actually often governed by the wealthiest people, the most powerful people from above, but there's a kind of alliance between them, a secret release of the energies from below by those on the top for their own interest. And Jack Cade is exactly that kind of figure. He claims, in fact, in Shakespeare's play, to be himself an aristocrat, though everyone knows that the claim is absolutely absurd. And his followers know that the claim is absurd. That's the odd thing.
Yeah.
So that they're laughing at the lies that he tells. Though they know they're lies, they're laughing and at the same time going along with everything that he is telling them. "My mother was a Plantagenet," he says. And one of his followers says, "Yeah, I knew her. She was a midwife." Or, "She's descendant of the Lacys." That's another aristocratic name. And another one says, "Yeah, she sold laces. She was a peddler's daughter," and so forth. I mean, they know it, but they're not. We think that when you're caught in a lie, if you're leading a political movement, you will lose power. But at least as Shakespeare depicts it, for a while in Henry VI, the movement continues to grow in force, not to diminish in force.
Well, one of his lines, Cade's lines, is, "The first thing we do, let's kill all the lawyers."
It's one of the most famous lines Shakespeare ever wrote.
Yeah.
Now, since you see it on bumper stickers
right.
or whatever. And that's a perfect example of what we're talking about, Doug, because on the one hand, we laugh. Why do we laugh? Yeah, it's funny. I mean, it releases a kind of aggression on our part toward the whole system, which seems so rigged. On the other hand, if you look with even a moment's care at the scene in Shakespeare or think for a moment about what it means you want to get rid of all the laws, all the restraints, all the contracts, mm-hmm. all the obligations that people have to one another. That's what it's really about in this play.
Yeah. 15 years after he writes Richard III, he writes Macbeth, Shakespeare's probably most celebrated tyrant. But what's interesting, I think, at first is, and I wanted to break some of this down as you do in the book, Macbeth he's reluctant at first to be king.
He is. He's horrified, in effect, by the thought that is somehow provoked in him, passing through his mind, but also provoked in him by the weird women, the witches, whatever they are. Mm-hmm. Something is triggered in him, but he's horrified by what's triggered in him. And after all, we can associate that with the way we are as people. I don't think in this regard particularly unusual confession that at various moments in my life, ideas pass through my mind that I censor or I'm horrified by. Mm-hmm. I don't act on them. But I take it that that's what it is to be human.
Yeah.
If you're holding your child at the top of a staircase, your infant, and he's screaming his head off, it might occur to you to throw the child down the stairs. You don't do it unless you're a psychopath. But you feel a kind of shock of the recognition that you could do something harmful. Mm. And it's in effect Macbeth who feels some version of that.
Yeah.
It crosses his mind, but at first only in the form of making his hair stand on end, he says, that he could do this. And then, of course, he writes the fateful letter to his wife about the encounter with these weird women on the heath, and she takes it from there.
Yeah. And once he does the deed, he's sort of goaded into it, humiliated into doing it by his wife. But once he does it, he's all in, and then comes this idea of self-defilement, self-loathing, and he begins to lose his mind, and that's what I wanted to ask you about. How does Shakespeare deal with those around him who are witnessing Macbeth losing his mind?
Well, I don't know that it's true that in this case that Macbeth loses his mind. He goes dead inside.
Yeah.
Macbeth, who had in the first act of the play, which is one of the greatest pieces of drama Shakespeare ever wrote, Macbeth is inwardly in turmoil, and he manages to share with us this titanic anxiety that he feels right up to the assassination of the king. And then what he depicts afterwards, you could say a going out of his mind, but a very peculiar form of it, which is just going dead inside,
yeah.
slowly getting colder and colder as life becomes less and less meaningful.
But they sense so it. They say His Highness is not well.
His Highness is not well when he, in a way, the last glimpse of the torments within him, when he tries to have the dinner party, the dinner party from hell, at his castle, and after he's killed his best friend Banquo, and sees Banquo's ghost, starts screaming, and has to leave the party, as it were. Mm-hmm. But after that, Doug, you don't see him behave that way. You just see him leading up to the feeling that he has at the end of the play that life is a tale told by an idiot, full of sound and fury, signifying nothing. And instead, it's his wife who is steely and contained and controlled and controlling at the beginning of the play, who becomes increasingly crazy. And so by the end of the play, she's suicidal. But so you get a kind of strange crisscross. What you do have in the case of Macbeth, and I think that's what you are asking about, and I think it's even more true in that late play of Shakespeare's Winter's Tale, is the problem of what to do when you see things, people around you who are in power, who are behaving in ways you understand to be dangerous and mad. In the case of Macbeth, the particular form of viciousness culminates in the killing of children. the children of Macduff. And Shakespeare doesn't depict the people around Macbeth as stopping this event, but simply carrying it out, the murderers that he sends to do it. In fact, earlier when he orders the killing of his best friend, likewise, just people will do it. People will do what they're told to do by the ruler, even if they might think to themselves that the authority figure has gone out of his mind. But some people leave. Some people escape, as the murdered king's children do, and his supporters, and they eventually will regroup and restore decency to the realm. But in that later play, Winter's Tale, you get a much more direct situation of what happens when the person running a country has gone out of his mind. Mm. And people in the inner circle perceive that he's gone out of his mind.
Yeah.
And Shakespeare's answer is not very encouraging, I'm sorry to say.
Right.
It's that it's extremely difficult if it's a person who is in power legitimately, even if he behaves in a crazy way, it's extremely difficult to stop that person. People try to say things. People indicate. People are frank, if they as frank at least as they dare to be. But there aren't really mechanisms, adequate mechanisms, in at least as Shakespeare imagines it, for intervening quickly enough to stop disaster.
It's interesting, the end of Macbeth. As you mentioned, he foresees his legacy won't be one of love or the honor of his friends, but, as he puts it, curses, not loud but deep. And then this I wanted to ask you about, mouth honor.
Yes, it's an amazing moment, amazing thing to describe, mouth honor, where Macbeth gets that what he's produced in his – we don't actually see this depicted, but what he's produced in his world, it's as if he has sat around with his advisors and asked them to praise him and tell him how extraordinarily gifted he is and how he deserves the highest admiration for everything he's done. And instead of simply being pumped up by that praise, Shakespeare depicts him as grasping inwardly that it's empty, that it's worthless, that it's all been for nothing.
I want to ask you about, you say in the book, societies have a way of protecting themselves from sociopaths, but there are times when some of the dangerous qualities of tyrants can be useful for people. Let's talk about Coriolanus. This is where you end your book with this story. It's the last tragedy that Shakespeare writes. Talk about how this fits in your story of tyrants.
It's a play that's much less well known than many of the plays we've been talking about, Doug. Though there was a very interesting film of it not so long ago with Ralph Fiennes and Vanessa Redgrave. But it's a late play, and as you say, it's the last tragedy that Shakespeare wrote. And for me, it was important for a number of different reasons. First of all, what emerged in the course of my writing Tyrant, to my surprise and to my deep pleasure, is a sense that there was a story, a plot in Shakespeare's own career in thinking about these problems. It wasn't that he kept simply coming back to the same problem again and again and finding different ways of dramatizing it, but that he worked his way slowly through a range of possible scenarios until he reached this one at the end of his career, a scenario in which a very powerful figure who represented what the play calls the right-hand file, the interests of the wealthiest people in the Roman – this is a play situated in the Roman Republic the person who represents the patricians who have all the money and power in the Roman world. This person finds his way toward the central office in the land. In this play, it's called the consul.
Yeah.
And the question is, and he's extremely unstable. He's enormously powerful and rather popular,
right,
because he's been a military hero, but extremely unstable. So the question is, how can he be stopped? And this is a fascinating and unexpected place for Shakespeare's theatrical imagination to go, because he imagines this figure having to stand for office, having to run for election, and having enormous advantages, both for huge wealth, the support of the patricians, but also a large base of popular support because he's a celebrity in his world. He's conquered the city of Caryllae and so forth and so on. He's done things for Rome. He's been genuinely brave, military leader. And what the play depicts is something surprising and weird, which is that he fails to achieve his goal, which is to be elected consul, not because he's assassinated, but because fairly modest, low-level, somewhat cynical, ordinary hack politicians figure out a way to insist on doing things according to the rules and are able to get through to the voters, the Roman voters, that he's not actually in their interest. He's not on their side, and they should actually vote, in this case, against his becoming consul. And when they do that, when they turn against him, he gets in a rage and goes into exile, goes over to the enemy, the Volscians, and threatens the Roman state and eventually loses. But that's the key turn in the play.
Yeah.
The moment at which ordinary, modest politicians insist on the rule of law state.
Right, as you put it in the book, that the saviors are those, here's how you put it, the much maligned professional politicians of congresses and parliaments everywhere. It's just like making the case to kind of refurbish the reputation of and the importance of the role of insisting on the rights of ordinary people. That seemed to be a theme for Shakespeare.
It was a theme for Shakespeare. It was an unusual claim politically, in fact, impossible claim politically in the late 16th, early 17th century. But as I've asked myself, how is it possible for Shakespeare to be making such a claim, I remind myself that his institution was one of the only institutions in his country, along with the church, I guess, in which everyone was welcome, in which it wasn't simply for the upper classes, and it also wasn't simply lower class entertainment. It was a space in which the rich and the poor, men and women, those who were in and those who were out, could come together. Mm-hmm. And Shakespeare understood, I think, all his career, that his allegiance lay with this large, diverse social group, and not simply, he decided, I think, early in his career, not to become what's called a coterie playwright, someone who writes only for the elite. He decided to write for a huge popular audience that included the elite and also included the illiterate.
Yeah. When dealing with a tyrant, you say Shakespeare didn't think the way forward was ever assassination. But as you put it in the book, that you say the best hope lay in the sheer unpredictability of collective life. Finally, Professor, what do you mean by that?
Well, of course, their unpredictability can lead to unpleasant surprises as well as happy ones.
Right.
So we might as well not delude ourselves.
Yeah.
But I think just as Shakespeare depicted things turning in directions that you would hope that they would never turn, that, for example, that the miserable Richard Duke of Gloucester, whom everyone understood was a psychopath, would nonetheless become king of England, it also worked the other way around.
Yeah.
That all the attempts that people make to try to control the situation, all the efforts that the now Putins of the world, the Erdogans of the world, the Orbans of the world, all the people who are in our Dutertes, all the people who are in our current situation who seem to control the whole apparatus of government, they think they can seize the future as well as the present, but they can't. It will turn in directions that they least expect.
That's Stephen Greenblatt. His book is called Tyrant, Shakespeare on Politics. He joined us from the studios at Harvard. Radio West is a production of KUER News. Our thanks to Holly Vasek. We had technical direction from Tim Slover. The program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.